It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. I'm Ann Strainchamps. I was one of those kids who didn't just read books. I lived inside them. I knew the landscape of Narnia better than my own neighborhood. Anne of Green Gables and Frodo and Jane Eyre, they were my best friends. For most of my life, the stories inside books have seemed as real and compelling as the world outside. But lately, something's been happening that kind of terrifies me. Books just don't pull me inside the way they used to. I mean, I pick up a book and I just can't quite settle in. And then I started hearing the same thing from other people. So what is this? Late onset dyslexia? Middle-aged ADHD? Or just my imagination?
It is not age. It is not imagination. What you're experiencing is what researchers call the new reading, which is skimming, browsing, word spotting, zigzagging, all of the sorts of ways that, in fact, are the antithesis of the readers we've been.
This is Marianne Wolfe. She's one of the world's leading experts on the neuroscience of reading. And here's what she thinks is happening. All that time we spend reading online, checking Facebook and Twitter, answering email, searching Google, she thinks that's actually rewiring our brains. And she warns that we're not just reading differently, we're also thinking differently.
And here's where I think it's really most threatening, if you will. It will actually change what is written, ultimately.
So have you had this experience, like picked up a book you think you should love or want to love
yes.
or did once love and just couldn't get into it?
This is a rather sad awakening to me. Last year, I decided, because I'm writing a new book on the reading brain, whether or not I had changed along with everyone else. But to test this like a scientist, I had myself pull out a very complex but beautiful book I once loved. And it was Magister Ludi, or The Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse. Yes, and I used to love this book.
But it is kind of a dense book, and
it is
500 pages long or something.
But I wanted to test myself because density is one of the things that we're losing. So the test was to choose a dense book whose plot I knew, and so I could really focus and immerse myself in it.
And did it have the same old magic?
Oh, it was just the worst possible experience a reading researcher can have. It was like molasses on the brain. I hated the book. I didn't want to go past the first chapter. I thought, why in the world has Hermann Hesse ever won a Nobel Prize for literature? And it was really one of the great wake-up calls in the last 2 years for me. And I realized I could not slow myself down, that I was attempting to, in fact, invoke the same reading style that I was using the rest of the day. It made the very experience of reading onerous and distasteful. I was so frustrated, I just practically thrust the book back and thought, that's it. And then I felt great remorse. Because all of these books, Anne, all of them, are the stuff from which our lives have been made, the insights that have made us who we are. So out of pure guilt, I took the book back the next day, and I forced myself to read just 20 minutes a day. And basically, it took me 2 weeks before I returned to what Klinkenborg said, the reader we've been.
Wait, did you get it back? Did you get to the point where it was delicious to curl back up with that book?
Oh, it was so much as if I had come back to my cerebral home in reading. And it was so good that I actually then allowed myself almost the luxury of reading it now for pure pleasure. And I read it a second time.
Hmm. Now, I want to push back for just a minute because...
Yes.
It's possible, of course, that literary taste is just changing, as it always has, you know.
And will.
In the 20th century, people yes. wrote different kinds of novels than they did in the 18th century, thank goodness. Mm. Maybe yes. we're not becoming worse readers. Maybe in some ways we're becoming more demanding readers. We want, you know, cleaner, clearer, crisper mm-hmm. writing than you know, Henry James or Hermann Hesse?
You know, it's a very thoughtful and pithy question, but I would find it a great impoverishment if the young of our next generation would have only a diet of the simplest of sentences, which would never properly represent the natural convolutions of complex thought. And so when I hear chairs of English departments lamenting that their students no longer want to take Henry James, just as you suggested, no longer want to read the sentences of George Eliot or Marcel Proust, that gives me an absolute fear that we will not have a generation who understands the richness that's possible in literature.
But I think it's what you're saying, right, is that it's not just whether or not we love and appreciate rich literature. I think what you're suggesting is that how we read is how we think. And that if we lose the ability to read and take pleasure in those deep, complex sentences, or maybe novels with multiple subplots and 100 characters, if we lose the ability to do that, we're not able to think in as complex a way. Is that right?
It's also not developing the ability to appreciate the great richness in words themselves. That will be lost if we have a skimming, browsing, word-spotting way of reading. The brain is very, very plastic. It will reflect how we read.
Why would it matter so much what we're reading? I mean, you know, we're still talking about words and print. Why does it matter whether the words in print are on a physical page or on a screen?
I think there are important advantages and disadvantages to both mediums. So I'd want to be sure that the real equation is not either or, but how do we enhance the experience of reading for the young by giving them what I will call a biliterate reading brain, one that knows when to use which mode for what material, under what circumstances and purposes.
What's the difference? What's good digital reading and versus what's good print reading?
So in print reading, we know a great deal about what makes a great expert reader. And part of that is time to process, time to take on the perspective of others. Now, with digital reading, there is both the reality and a quasi-illusion that all you have to do is press another button, if you will, and you will have access to all kinds of information instead of having your own. So I would love to have the sense that our young are learning how to slow themselves down and not depend on another click, and learn not to be so easily distracted that they become what people like Seymour Papert and Howard Gardner call grasshopper minds. We have to fight this peripatetic mind that many of our children have. They are hyper readers. We have to almost rein in their natural desire to go to the next stimulus, to teach them those focused reading skills that print reading really fosters very nicely.
I guess I'm curious, what does this mean, say, for students today who have to balance doing focused reading for school and with their, you know, constant online digital consumption, you know, their texting and even research they may have to do for school?
There are two things that are happening at the same time, or even three, that really make almost a perfect storm for our students: the glut of information, the amount of distractions, and their absolute recognition that they can't possibly consolidate all of this in their memory. And so they are, you know, using other people's thoughts more than their own. All this information has a good aspect and a bad, but it's fragmenting rather than helping them become more logical thinkers. So my hope is that we can really make people aware of this fragmentation of attention so that they will learn how to focus more and enjoy being immersed instead of moving from one stimulus or one device to another.
Marianne Wolfe is a child development professor at Tufts University. She's also an expert on dyslexia and the author of Proust and the Squid, the story and science of the reading brain.
What do writers do when they seriously notice the world?
Writer and literary critic James Wood.
The writer's task is to bring meaning, color, and life back to the most ordinary things, to soccer boots and grass, to cranes and trees and airports, and even to Gibson guitars and Roland amplifiers and Old Spice and Ajax.
James Wood is often called the best critic of his generation. He made his name writing, I don't want to call them hatchet jobs exactly, but extremely scathing book reviews. That was when he was in his 20s and working for The Guardian. Today he's a staff writer at The New Yorker and a professor of literary criticism at Harvard. It's hard to explain his status in the book world. There's one blogger who put it nicely recently. He said he's arguably the most celebrated, possibly the most impugned, and definitely the most envied literary journalist living. James Wood has just published a new collection of essays called The Nearest Thing to Life. And Steve Paulson wanted to know what he thinks he's learned from a lifetime of close reading.
I don't think that I am naturally an especially observant person, certainly not visually. I did a lot of music when I was a kid, and so I have good ears, and I'm always listening. But I'm one of those people who tends not to look hard enough at, you know, a tree that I walk past or to notice, you know, what someone's hands looked like 20 minutes after I said goodbye to them. And I'm aware that literature has helped me to become a better noticer by being so full of noticing itself. And then, of course, as a professional reader, I'm continually sort of training and tutoring that particular art.
And to follow up on the strands of your own life, you are married to a novelist, and you've also worked with some famous writers. For instance, didn't you once teach a college course with Saul Bellow?
I did. I did indeed. I was brought in because Mr. Bellow was in his 80s and was beginning to lose his memory. And it was felt that it would be useful to have someone else in the class.
So what was your job there?
I had a lovely job. My job was to his deep memory, as is so often the case with people who are beginning to lose their memory, was terrific. His short-term memory was full of lapses. So my job really was to nudge him and prod him. So we did a Dostoevsky novella, we did Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Illich. So when it came to people like Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, I would simply say, now, Mr. Bellow, you grew up in Chicago in the 20s and 30s when writers like Tolstoy or Dostoevsky and your relation to them were vital. You were either a Tolstoyan or a Dostoevskian. Can you just tell the class a little bit about that? And he was off. I mean, it was extraordinary. Right to the end of his life, I used to go to his house sometimes and I would accompany him on the piano. I would play the piano, he would play the recorder. Once I brought my 2-year-old daughter, and Bellow started singing French children's songs, one after the other. It was extraordinary. In French, with all the stanzas and all the verses and the tunes, right? And I said, this is extraordinary. And he said, well, I picked them up when I was in Paris writing The Adventures of Augie March. I had a child. I was pushing the child around in a stroller, and I used to sing these songs. And that was 50 or 60 years ago. It was amazing to me.
Wow. Saul Bellow was one of those writers who strived for literary greatness. I mean, he was kind of upfront about this. And there have been a handful of writers who sort of, you know, they wanted to be regarded as great. Is that something that you look for when you pick up a new book? I mean, are you also looking for greatness?
You know what? I think this may be the wisdom of middle age, if one can talk about wisdom of middle age, sort of the reverse of the red sports car, as it were. I think I'm a little less hung up on greatness than I used to be. And maybe correspondingly, I'm a somewhat less severe judge than I used to be.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, you made your name when you were the chief book reviewer for The Guardian, and you had kind of a reputation for writing brutal reviews.
Yeah, I did. I was always taking people to the cleaners. you know, I still love that sort of that kind of sweeping thing of, you know, it's all rubbish. You know, nothing's good being written in England since, you know, 1945. I love to see it in critics because it's a sign to me that they're taking the form deadly seriously.
But it sounds like you're saying that you have become a more generous critic since then.
I think I have, yeah. Indeed, in some respects, I'm slightly put off by massive ambition, you know, by the sort of 600-700-page book that's trying to do 50 things at once. And there's part of me that relishes smaller effects. You know, it seems to me that one of the easier things in our culture now is to make a lot of noise. And this can be aided and abetted often by, you know, the publishing machinery that happily says, you know, you're young, you're making a lot of noise, we will anoint you as a noisemaker, a.k.a. ambitious, and we'll push the book out there. You know, I think obviously it's important still to take note of those big attempts that are being made to write great literature. But I'm also interested in simplicity.
Hmm. Now, in addition to being a book critic, you also teach a class at Harvard on the practice of literary criticism. So what is the art of being a good book critic?
Ooh, I think it's the art of persuasion. You know, one of the ways in which I get both institutional respect, a rather tiresome kind, and a fair amount of attack because of that institutional authority has to do with this thing of, you know, being at the New Yorker. Then when you, as it were, square it with the Harvard thing, you get a sort of horrific, sort of horrible
Your pedestal, you know, you stand like, on is pretty tall.
Right. So, right, here's your throne and we'll build an extra, you know, 10 feet of gold for you to sit on for the pedestal. And that's really tiresome to me, as is the whole thing about being, you know, this awful word, gatekeeper, you know, sort of gatekeeper critic. I can't think of anything worse and, by the way, more corrupting to the soul than to think that, you know, by a stroke of the pen, you know, I command this or that person's career or reputation.
Can you still read purely for pleasure without always having your critical hat on, even if it's a book that you're not reviewing?
Well, I think the way to answer that is I can't read without my critical hat on, but I don't think that reading with my critical hat on is incompatible with pleasure or even with pure pleasure in the way that, you know, that I might, you know, secretly be in love with really bad television. I mean, I understand what the phrase pure pleasure is getting at, which would be some kind of surrendering to the text without really much self-consciousness at all.
Well, and without feeling compelled to evaluate it.
I'm always evaluating it. But then when I think back, I realize that I always was anyway, and that for me, pleasure is evaluative pleasure as well as the pure enjoyment of, you know, just, which I certainly still experience, of, you know, wanting to put an exclamation mark in the margin of the page because I've just been bowled over by something. You know, wow, just the wow thing is very strong in me.
Now, you mentioned that you have kind of a guilty pleasure of watching mainstream TV shows. Do you also have guilty literary pleasures?
Here's the thing. I don't really have guilty literary pleasures. I don't know what the explanation for it is, because I certainly have literary friends who love genre fiction, whether it's science fiction or, you know, thrillers. I never read that stuff. I never did. I never have done. Sometimes I think that's just me being slightly anxious. I put it down.
Anxious.
Right? I put it down to a sort of literary anxiety that somehow I don't have the time for it.
You don't think it's good enough, right?
Right. I don't think it's good enough. But then the reason I say that I think it's anxious is it's not like I'm a man without guilty pleasures. So if I have guilty pleasures in other areas, we mentioned TV, that's certainly one. What other guilty pleasures? I mean, you know, I love cars, right? I absolutely love cars. So I read car magazines. Car magazines are, you know, it's not exactly a sin to read a car magazine, but you know, they are what they are. It's essentially, you know, car porn. So I'm not without guilty pleasures. I know what it means to sort of balance the high and the low and to be hospitable towards the low or relaxed around the low.
You just don't want that in your literature.
I don't want it in my – I actually think it might contaminate in some way. That's where I think I'm a little bit anxious.
Hmm. You wrote one novel yourself. Do you have a hankering to write more fiction?
I do. I'm actually working at a novel right now. My wife, who's a novelist, will often say, you know, you sit down and you think, okay, I'm just going to start writing. And then you look up 3.5 hours later and you really didn't know where the time went. You got lost. And that getting lost is clearly crucially important for creativity, but also a source of terror for me, because I don't know what I'm holding on to anymore. I don't know where the thread is going, and I don't quite know how to find it again.
You also must figure that all those writers out there are sharpening their daggers waiting for your book to come out.
Oh, indeed. It's a perpetual fantasy of mine, as it was with the first novel, to publish it under a pseudonym. Of course, it's a bit of a wager, because there's first the wager of, will you get it published?
Of course you'll get it published. I mean,
but if you did it under a pseudonym,
oh, yes.
If you just sent it as a pseudonym, there's a possibility that it wouldn't get published.
Right.
And then if you continue the wager, there's a possibility that it wouldn't get reviewed at all and would just disappear. And you're the sore loser. There's no kind of triumphal announcement a year later. Ah, this book that everyone's been paying attention is actually by James Wood. In fact, it just disappeared under its pseudonym. I used to write occasionally pseudonymous things when I was first starting out. I have two middle names, Douglas and Graham, and I needed to earn a living writing paperback roundup reviews. And I thought this hack work, which it really is, it's little more than just 50-word précis stuff, should exist in a different, slightly different realm from what I was trying to do as a fiction reviewer. So for a while I was writing under James Wood and Douglas Graham, so maybe that's what I should do with the novel, although I've just blown my cover on radio.
That's New Yorker critic James Wood. His new book is called The Nearest Thing to Life. You can read the full interview in Electric Lit. The link's on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the story of how one Jordanian woman got thousands of kids all over the Middle East to fall in love with books. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you like this show, do us a favor and share it with someone who's never listened to a podcast before. When you do, let us know by tweeting at us with the hashtag Tripod. That's TRYPOD. And thanks for promoting podcast awareness. We're talking about the art of reading in this hour. One of the pleasures of this job is bringing you stories about how one person can change the world. So here's one. Rana Dajani is a molecular biologist from Jordan. She earned her PhD here in the States. She's also a mother. She has four kids. And while the family was living here, they had a nightly ritual where Rana would read out loud to the children. And then the family moved back to Jordan.
So, of course, I carried on reading to my children and buying them books. But we realized that there's a problem in Jordan and in the Arab world that children and even adults don't read. And when I say reading, I don't mean reading for education, because everybody in Jordan goes to school, the literacy rate is very high, everybody goes to university, so it's not that kind of reading. And not religious reading, because everybody reads their Quran or their Bible. What I mean by reading is reading for pleasure, the reading that opens your imagination, that develops your character, that makes you see, understand other people's perspectives, makes you listen, makes you go beyond time and space, to learn about other people's experiences, and actually to know that there's another way. I don't have to be limited within the confinement of my community. So, being a scientist, I looked around to find out why don't children read. And I found out that the reason they don't read is not for lack of books, as many people think. Actually, it's lack of being read to, lack of the experience. So I knew the solution. The solution is to read aloud to these children. And knowledge is responsibility, and I felt that I have to do something. And Prophet Muhammad said, everyone is a guardian. So I was a guardian. I had to do something. And actually, I felt if I didn't do this, nobody else is going to do it. So it's like the fate of all these children were on my shoulders. So with the help of my family, we thought we're going to start read aloud sessions in our own neighborhood. I wanted a public place. And in Jordan, every neighborhood has a mosque. So we thought we could use the mosque. It's a great place. It's got a carpet, a bathroom. It's open to the public. And the children can come on their own accord while they're playing in the street. So it's a great place. And it's in every neighborhood. So the model could be copied. So I went to my neighborhood mosque, and I contacted the officials there, and they were very welcoming because they know me, they know my husband, they know my children, because it's part of the community. And we used the Friday prayers to announce that we're going to have a read aloud, so it's a perfect model for communication. The first time, we got 25 children, and the ages of the children were from 4 to 10. Boys and girls, because above 10 they have a different type of book and it's more difficult to plant the love of reading, and younger than 4 you would have to involve the parents, and forget about the parents, you'd have to convince them. That's very difficult. Plus we wanted to plant in the children the feeling of ownership and independence, that they want to come because they are enjoying it themselves. The children came the first time because their parents dragged them. As any parent, they hear of an activity, they take their children. And the children didn't want to come to the mosque at all. But then I wear a funny hat and I have my puppets. I read 2 to 3 books. And the stories relate to the children's everyday life, so they can see themselves in the book. Then the children line up and they take the books home so they can relive the experience in their own homes. And that's the key for planting the love of reading, is to take the book home and use it. The children had a great time, and next time they were waking up dragging their parents that we wanted to go to the mosque to listen to the stories. So we empowered the children, and we succeeded. And I measure success because these children, when they line up, they know the names of authors, they recommend books to each other, and actually it doesn't cost anything because I paid the first batch of books, but then the mosque was so happy about what was going on that the children were reading, they were off the streets, they started giving me money to buy books. So it's a very sustainable model. And actually, we calculated it costs less than $50 to make a child read forever. So we're looking for partners, and hopefully we will able to fulfill our dream to have a library in every neighborhood in Jordan, in the Arab world, in the whole world, wherever children do not read, to encourage them to read for pleasure.
Rana Dajani is a molecular biologist. She's also the founder and director of We Love Reading. Her program has reached more than 10,000 children in 330 libraries in Jordan. It's now spread across the Middle East, from Lebanon and Egypt to Turkey and Saudi Arabia and many other countries. So it's one thing to talk about how we read today, but can we ever know how people used to read, like 500 years ago? Did Shakespeare curl up with a book at night? Did Jane Austen or Frederick Douglass read for fun? Historian Anthony Grafton is kind of obsessed with the question of how people used to read as a way of getting a glimpse of the past. Years ago, when he was a grad student at Cambridge, he began paying attention to what our ancestors wrote in the margins of their books. He recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson about the history of reading.
It turned out that in the 16th and 17th century, reading was a very active process. And I guess I might compare it to the way a lot of us read on a computer now. But you read pen in hand, ready to react, to write yourself into the margin of the book in all kinds of ways. It's a very tactile thing. From the age of manuscripts, it was common for readers to draw elegant little hands in the margin at the points that interested them, as if they were talking about the touch experience of reading. And the point that you touch is also the point that touches you.
I have to tell you that I still, when I read, I usually underline, although I tend not to actually write in the books.
Yeah, I don't write in books either, but I underline and bend pages over, I'm ashamed to admit. But Isaac Newton did that. So I began to realize that there was another way of reading and that people were responding to books. They were telling me things about their own lives as if a book was a kind of margins of a book were a kind of autobiography.
So can you give me an example of this? I mean, what have you learned about some writer or a reading experience by looking at all of these notes that have been written in books?
Sure. Here's one of my favorite examples. Henry Cornelius Agrippa was a magician, and he wrote the One Occult Philosophy, which is the standard Renaissance handbook of magic. And for decades, generations, historians have assumed that insofar as he tells you that magic recipes or methods work, he's a charlatan. So at one point in this book, he says, "So I'm going to tell you how you can project a message on the face of the moon. You write the message in blood on a mirror at the time of the full moon, and then it will appear on the moon." And I thought, okay, that's ridiculous. But I happened to find a copy that belonged to a very serious reader who writes at that point, "Yes, I saw this done in 1552. And that comment stuck with me. And a couple of years after I read it, I met a perceptual psychologist. And I said, "Can you give me any help with this? I have this guy who says he can do a bat signal in the Renaissance. And I have somebody else who says, yeah, I saw the bat signal. I saw this projected." And he explained exactly how it's done. Red is the color that leaves residue the longest in your eye. When you see red, it'll stay longer than any other color. And the other part of this, my perceptual psychologist friend was also an amateur magician. He said, "I'll tell you exactly how it was done. You're in a pre-modern world, so it's really dark at night. You go out on the full moon." He says it's full moon. "Full moon's going to be incredibly bright, much brighter than we can now imagine."
Because there were no lights.
Because there are no lights, so there's no contrast with it. And I had actually visited my daughter in the Peace Corps in Africa, so I knew exactly what he meant because her village wasn't electrified. I'd even seen this. And he said, "So you write a message on the mirror with the light of the moon illuminating it. You write it in red and you get people to look and then you snatch it away and say, 'Look at the moon, it's there.' They're going to see it on the moon."
Wow.
It's a magic trick, but it's a real story. Henry Cornelius Agrippa is a very amiable kind of guy. One of the things I really liked about him was he hated the persecution of witches, and he actually intervened to save witches who were on trial. And I'd always wondered why he told these fibs, and the answer is he wasn't telling fibs. He was a conjurer, but not a charlatan.
Hmm. Well, I mean, what you're also suggesting is that centuries ago, I mean, we're talking what century?
This is the 1530s.
1530s. Maybe reading was a more powerful experience than it is now. I mean, people sort of took what they were reading to almost literal levels.
Oh, they really did. Machiavelli talks about going to the bar and playing cards with his neighbors and yelling and being stupid. Then he says, "And I come home and I wash and I put on my golden robes and the great men of antiquity come to me and I ask them questions and in their humanity they answer me." So this is a vision of reading like a Renaissance court dance. It's ceremonious, it's elegant, it's beautiful, but it's also very intense and it has to be done right. So yes, reading had the keys to the knowledge that people most wanted. In the late 16th century, for example, people begin to read obsessively the Roman historian Tacitus, who's the great realist historian of the Roman Empire, the one who tells you the black secrets of empire. And they read Tacitus. It's like Edward Snowden putting things out on the web. Mm. This is a revelation. This is how things really work. Only the revelation now comes from digital media and then just came from books that hadn't been read or studied in the same way.
Well, and I would think that if people were reading sacred texts like the Bible, the stakes would even be higher.
And there you really see something different. I think that it's very clear to me that in the 16th and 17th centuries, people reading the Bible thought the book was moving them, not they moving the book.
Hmm. Nowadays, because God was speaking directly to them.
And if they were in the proper condition when they read the book would tell them how to read it, tell them how to make sense of it. That's what Martin Luther really says about his discovery, as he felt it, that salvation comes by faith in God alone. He's reading, and suddenly he sees how to line up all of the significant texts in the Bible. So reading is complicated, it's contentious, it's a source of incredible arguments, and people die over these arguments in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Do you ever get envious about how people used to read back then? I mean, that it was such a powerful experience that I don't think we can have that anymore.
So one of the people I study, Isaac Casaubon, a great 16th century scholar, tells us he would always comb his hair before he went upstairs to read. And then he would sit down in his study and he would pray. And only then would he open his books and read. So it's not necessarily a religious experience. He's often reading secular books, but there's a kind of religious intensity to what he's doing. And I actually found, as I began really getting into the history of books, and my first students started really getting into computers and programming, that I understood those students better. When a student would turn up at my office hours in pajamas with green skin because, you know, he or she had been, you know, in the computer lab for seven straight days coding something, that's the way people read in the 16th century. Now it's the new media and the new machines that attract that kind of total passionate engagement.
Well, do you think the experience of reading changes as the technology changes? I mean, if you're reading, I don't know, a handwritten manuscript as opposed to a printed book, as opposed to now, you know, reading on a screen.
Technology doesn't always change reading. But if you read on screen, there are a couple of things that are really quite worrying about it. One is that if you use a camera and track the eye movements of someone reading on a computer screen, you don't actually look at the whole screen. You go across the top of the screen, you go down a bit, you make a sort of second cross movement that isn't long.
Then you're kind of skimming more.
Well, your eye moves in the shape of an F when you read on screen. So what's on the bottom right, you just don't even see.
And this is different than reading on a printed
People don't do this reading on a printed page. You do this reading on a screen. If you're doing web design, you'd bear this in mind. And web designs often are F-shaped, so that the stuff on the bottom right is the stuff that doesn't matter. Hmm. Or they use really powerful visual elements to jerk you out of the F and call your attention to the part of the page that isn't in the F. But suppose you're reading a page of prose on screen. You're going to miss the bottom right. You're going to miss part at the top right and every page.
That's so interesting. I have to tell you that I've just noticed that I read differently on a screen versus on the printed page. And maybe this is just my own peculiarity. I know that I don't read as carefully if it's on a screen. I tend to skim. I'm the classic web surfer. I'm sort of trying to consume a lot of information quickly. And I'm a much more careful reader if it's a printed book.
It's absolutely true. We do know that any way you read wires your brain. If you learn to read Chinese, it wires one part of your brain. If you learn to read an alphabetic language, it wires a different part of your brain. And we can tell this from what lights up when you read. It's also possible to have a stroke if you're bilingual and lose your Western reading ability while keeping your Chinese reading ability,
really?
Or vice versa.
So does that mean a Chinese person has a different experience of reading than an American?
Probably, yes, but not when he's reading the same things that an American reads. So reading wires you. Reading scrolls must have wired us one way. Reading the codex book must have wired us one way. And what we don't know is whether eventually we will adapt, being the kinds of clever monkeys that we are, to the point where we can read on screen as effectively as we read on paper.
Oh, fascinating history. Thank you so much.
A pleasure.
Tony Grafton is a historian at Princeton. He talked with Steve Paulson. And that wraps up our conversation about reading. Coming up, Asian underground composer and DJ Karsh Kalay reflects on two decades of mixing East and West. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Sarah Bakewell, author of At the Existentialist Cafe and How to Live a Life of Montaigne. My favourite book, my recommendation, is Say Sean Argon's The Pillow Book, in the translation by Ivan Morris. But the reason I'm so drawn to this book is that it's a real encounter for me with strangeness, and also it's just a lot of fun. Sei Shon Argon lived in Japan in the late 10th century, and she was a lady-in-waiting at the court of the Empress. And we don't really know an awful lot else about her, except that she kept this collection of notes, which they called soshi, or pillow book, just casual jottings of things that she wanted to write about. So she referred to her collection of notes as a pillow book, a casual jottings. She spoke of it quite dismissively, but that's a classic essayist gesture of self-deprecation, because it's actually a wonderful collection of quite cheeky and challenging thoughts, observations, bits of gossip from the court, bits of poetry, rules of etiquette. She had a particular fondness for lists, so she'd list, for example, rare things, squalid things, presumptuous things, or, this is a category that I like, things that one is in a hurry to see or to hear. Among that list are a letter from a man that one loves, but also other odd things such as uneven shading and all forms of dappled dyeing. So there's this constant strangeness of the things that she talks about mixed in with things that we can relate to. Another example is she describes some of the festivals and some of the court rituals that went on. The festival of the full moon gruel was a day in which a bowl of gruel is presented to the emperor, and on that day all the women carry gruel sticks which they hide carefully from each other, and she says it's most amusing to see them walking about as they await an opportunity to hit their companions. Each one is careful not to be struck herself and is constantly looking over her shoulder, but it's useless, of course, because they always succeed in hitting each other. It's a book that is so delightful to encounter, but it confronts us with the sheer strangeness of the past and the strangeness of reading itself. And I could quote another favourite author of mine, Gabrielle Marcel, who said, "I know from my own experience how from a stranger met by chance there may come an irresistible appeal which overturns habitual perspectives, just as a gust of wind might tumble down the panels of a stage set. What seemed near becomes infinitely remote, and what seemed distant becomes close." And I love that quote. It applies to me so much to this book, in which you have this recognition, a sense of closeness to this young woman in the court, but you also have a sense of great remoteness, and it reminds us of just how unknowable the past is.
Sarah Bakewell recommends The Pillow Book by Sei Shon Argon. You can find more bookmarks plus an interview with Bakewell on our website. That's at ttbook.org. If you like electronic dance music with an Indian or Asian beat, then you might know the name Kersh Kale. If not, well, I bet you've heard his music. Kersh Kale is one of the pioneers of the Asian underground. He grew up in Brooklyn, the son of Indian parents. He learned to play the tabla, and then he started mixing it up. Today, Rolling Stone magazine calls him the High Priest of Electro. He gets top billing at clubs from Ibiza to New York City. He's remixed Give Peace a Chance with Yoko Ono. He's written songs with Sting. He's even DJed with Barack Obama in the White House. He's also scored a lot of Bollywood movies. Charles Monroe Kane caught up with him to talk about Kale's new album, Up, which blends his two cultures, Indian and American.
You call yourself a musical translator between the U.S. and India. What needs translated?
Well, I think that experience, you know, the things that people go through in their lives, I mean, making people feel like we're, you know, from the same place. You know, I think at this point, being a traveler, being a traveling musician, I feel more so that there's so much more similarities in the places that I visit than there are differences. So I feel like, you know, that's what the point of the music is.
I've been blowing in the wind, but the wind could blow me over. Take it to a place that I can rest my head until the storm is over. I reach out to the sun for an answer to a riddle.
Take me to a place where up is down, cause I'm just caught up in the middle.
I'm not really trying to describe America to India and India to America. I think it's more about describing an experience that winds up becoming much more universal. You know, it's not necessarily about being either or. It's about seeing that something so particular from a particular place can be taken out of context and married so well with something completely, you know, which would be considered disparate or out of context, and brought together and almost speaking the same language.
I think I'm on my way now. I think I'm going under. I'm sitting in the dark, my eyes are shut, but I still see the colors. But I still see the colors.
Definitely music brings people together on a different level, you know, because we're, you know, we wake up in the morning and then we're constantly kind of divided into groups.
Yeah.
We're divided into, you know, different cultural groups, economic groups, you know, racial groups, whatever it is. And it's always about the perspective we choose to take, you know, and sometimes music gives us a different perspective on where we are in the world, where we stand in the world, how we're, who we're truly aligned with in the world. You know, all of those things don't necessarily need to be informed by the kind of the normal media outlets that we are, you know, kind of inundated with on a daily basis. So that's what always, I mean, feel like that's what music and art, what they're able to do is cut through all of that.
How? Tell me how.
We choose in our day, how, you know, the perspective we take on where we stand in the world. I mean, if you're spending your entire day kind of looking at the world from a political perspective, then you're going to see yourself within that political perspective. But if you see yourself in a different, more abstract perspective where you realize that people pretty much all over the world want the same things. They want, you know, they want to wind up with the same things. They want to die with the same things. They want to, you know, these are things that make the world a lot more similar. Culture just simply becomes different spices, different flavors of the same thing, as opposed to reasons why we cannot communicate.
You're American, but you're an immigrant, mm-hmm. and that being an immigrant, a first-generation immigrant in America, has huge meaning through the whole history of American culture. How does that affect how you look at this?
I've always kind of had to deal with the fact that, like, there was an explanation that was needed that was never really being able to put into words. I mean, for instance, growing up in Queens or in Long Island, basically in a predominantly white Jewish neighborhood, you know, there was really no context for an Indian immigrant back then, I think. I mean, it's very different now than it was when I was growing up. You know, so there's this incredible alienation, this huge void that gets created. And for, you know, for some of us, we were able to kind of start to fill that void with a culture that we were able to kind of create through our art. So that's kind of the reaction to that alienation, that void. You know, I mean, there were many different things that I did as I was growing up to deal with that. But I think the most effective thing I did was to put it into the art form that I decided to create.
Let's talk about that art you've decided to create, because the art is distinctly American and distinctly Indian. How did you start in putting things like a tabla or a sitar into American music?
It really started from, you know, when I was a kid. I mean, my father was constantly singing Indian melodies. He was constantly singing classical melodies or film melodies. And when he would hear anything that we were playing, whether it was Michael Jackson or The Police or Def Leppard or anything that was playing on the radio, he would start singing Indian melodies on top of it.
That sounds fantastic.
To the point where it would just drive us crazy. You know, we would be like, please stop. But there's something to, you know, I mean, if you would have asked me this question 10 years ago, I probably wouldn't have answered this way. But I know that this is where it comes from now, is my ability to be able to hear these things as one, you know, when I hear, if I come up with a chord progression or, you know, something that, you know, was inspired by, you know, somebody like a Peter Gabriel or something like that, that all of a sudden an Indian melody will just fly right on top of it.
Wow.
Definitely comes from the fact that my dad used to do that incessantly when we were growing up to everything we were listening to. My goal when I make music is not to necessarily tell a story, but to help tell your story. In that, I mean, for me, music has always been a guide and a soundtrack to my own life. So I always feel like the music that I make should become a soundtrack to other people's lives. So in that way, there is an arc to it. There's always a, I mean, I don't try and just kind of create a mood and let that play for 5 minutes. I mean, I try and take people on a bit of a journey, whether it be throughout the album or whether it be through a song. But it's definitely important to me that people take a journey, you know, whether it be taking themselves through a healing process or through a dark space or whatever it is. You know, I mean, if that's the way I'm feeling, I try and put that entire emotional arc into a piece so that hopefully somebody else can kind of mirror that in their own story.
That's amazing, because I'm thinking you're also a proficient tabla player, and tablas in its tradition tell a story, and you're combining the two. You're like, almost two stories are happening. How does that work?
Well, I think that oftentimes you realize that a lot of the stories, a lot of the things that you're trying to say are the same story. So sometimes you can put them into the same context. And, you know, like, for instance, I mean, I've said this for years, bringing together, like, the, you know, ancient mythology of India, like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. If you read those texts and you look at the story of, say, A New Hope, the Star Wars, the first one that came out with Luke Skywalker, there's such huge similarities in those stories, you know, and it's just different ways of telling the same kind of story. So I'm kind of using the language that I've learned and being able to use that language in order to create my own stories. We can analyze and intellectualize and review music all we want, but we really cannot judge how music touches people and how much it means to somebody at a particular time in their lives. I mean, for me, you know, when I make music, I can only hope that, you know, there's somewhere out there, you know, in however many thousands of people that might listen to the music, that for someone it's profound. You know, for someone it's a moment in their lives that this just becomes the sound and the soundtrack of what they're going through. You know, that's there's nothing more powerful than that, you know, in terms of one's relationship with music.
That's Kersh Kale talking with Charles Monroe Kane about his newest album called Up. And that's it for our show today, but there's always more in our podcast feed. To sign up, visit iTunes or Stitcher, or visit our website at ttbook.org. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tangakar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.